Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Alan Waziri. He's a neurosurgeon and a translational neuroscientist, and he's also the CEO and co-founder of ICE Neurosystems. Alan, thanks for joining me today.
Nick, it's fantastic to join you. Thank you very much for the invitation.
So for the benefit of the listeners, tell us a little bit about your background. It's really interesting. It's very focused on the area that we're going to be talking about. Help us understand you and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. So I've been kind of involved with medicine my entire life. Both of my parents were academic physicians, and I almost grew up in my dad's lab, actually studying synaptic transmission, you know, from an early age. And so that kind of continued on through college and then medical school and ultimately residency and my postdoc. So I've always been interested in the brain. I have to say, you know, the first time I saw the brain during medical school, it was kind of an obvious choice of which direction to go in. So neurosurgery was the path that I chose. And kind of more focused in that area, I've been primarily involved with intracranial surgery and focused quite a bit on taking care of patients with malignant brain tumors. But I've had a long and lasting interest in how the brain functions in terms of its communication with itself and with the outside world. And that's kind of where our interest in EEG comes from. And that's always been percolating in the background. I've done quite a bit of work in that over the past, you know, 20 years. And so what I'm doing now is really kind of all in on that aspect of neuroscience.
So, you know, from an external standpoint, what are our opportunities for understanding what's going on inside this device? What have we got today?
So there's obviously been a tremendous amount of really high power work that has gone into trying to understand how the brain not just functions, but how it's organized, how it develops, how it interfaces with itself and with the outside world. And there have been a lot of different layers of that understanding, you know, all the way from the cellular DNA level, all the way up to the imaging, you know, even going back, you know, centuries to understanding how injuries to different parts of the brain can affect external functions. We still have a long way to go. I think that we really are still just scratching the surface of how the whole machine is integrated. The brain is really a fairly beautiful, three-dimensional, modulatable, continuously shifting computer. And I think that's one of the things that's hard for people to conceptualize is that there isn't another entity out there in the world that's like the brain. So I think, once again, as I said, we're just starting to scratch the surface of how we understand that. I guess what's driven my interest recently is that we don't even really have good data from the clinical scenario of how the brain functions, not just normally, but in abnormal situations where the brain may be injured or dysfunctional. That's largely related to technical factors. And so I and my colleagues have spent, you know, quite a bit of time over the past 15 years trying to address that issue to try to collect better data so that we can move forward and generate real information about pathological states associated with brain injury.
So one of the primary methods that we have, I think, you know, many people would be familiar with the EEG. It's a sort of mechanism for monitoring brain waves. I mean, to the outside eye, you look at that and go, well, it's just a bunch of squiggles. Now, to be fair, that's true with the EKG for some folks as well. And, you know, there's some insights. Help us understand a little bit about what that is and the sort of the methodology behind that.
Yeah, so that's a brilliant point, and I think it's a really great way to understand, you know, where we are comparing the heart and the brain. So, you know, there's not a single medical show where you don't have a bedside monitor with the heart rate being displayed, and the concerned doctor is looking at the waveform, and the beeping is going on, and then there's a flat line when the heart stops. You know, everybody understands how that works. Basically, the heart generates spontaneous electrical activity as a basic element of its function. The brain does the same thing. The problem is that the brain is far more complicated, but there are also technical issues with actually detecting the electrical signals. The transmission of the electrical signals from the heart is fairly uniform. You know, the heart fires and all the myocytes kind of contract in a uniform fashion. And so you can follow this wave of depolarization through the heart. The brain has billions of neurons that are organized, you know, not just in terms of kind of large assemblies, but down to the level of cortical columns, which may be 100 microns in size, that are all oscillating together. And you have to take those accumulated electrical potentials at any moment in time. Those electrical potentials have to make their way out of the brain through the fluid and the wrapping around the brain, through the skull, through the scalp, and then they have to be transmitted to these metal contacts through a conductive gel and then amplified by some hardware. And so that you pointed out really the critical problem that we've had with EEG for years is that getting high enough quality signals that are free of noise that will allow us to do more automated or computer generated analysis, we've really made very little progress on that. Many very smart people have been working for decades to try to solve that problem. And that ultimately is just, it's a simple technical problem. You know, the biological to metallic interface is just poor. The electrical signals are low amplitude, and they represent, you know, kind of an amalgamation of all the independent rhythms that are generated by the various, you know, kind of smaller components of the brain. The advantage, though, is that the brain, as with the heart, demonstrates consistent changes with pathological alterations. So, for example, if somebody has a heart attack, there are particular abnormalities that we can see in the waveforms that can be easily recognized by a computer, actually. You know, EKG is probably one of the first spaces where machine learning was used in medicine. To be totally honest, as you were mentioning, I can't really effectively read an EKG, but I can read the three lines of text at the top that tell me if it's normal sinus rhythm and if the patient's having an MI and so on and so forth. We should be able to do the same thing with the brain. We have the same kinds of quantitative approaches to analyzing the waveform data, but the key is that the data going in has to be clean enough and of a high enough quality that the computer can analyze that without, you know, having a lot of artifacts or aberrations or things that render interpretation impossible. And so ultimately, that's where we want to go. Many smart people have spent years evaluating traditional EEG and trying to develop means of reducing artifact or reducing noise. We're trying to bypass that problem in kind of more simple fashion by improving the signal to noise ratio and making it easier to perform. That's another aspect of EEG that is a major concern right now, is that it's very technically complicated. With an EKG, we stick a total of 6 electrodes on the chest. You know, an intrepid high school volunteer that's, you know, volunteering at the hospital can place those electrodes on and push start on the machine for an EKG. For EEG, it requires a trained technician to place, you know, the 19 to 20 electrodes, you know, over the surface of the head and then plug in all the wires into the equipment and make sure that everything is functioning normally. And so it's not something that is really amenable to use in the vast majority of clinical scenarios. A recent publication suggested that less than 1% of the patients in the U.S. that would benefit from continuous EEG are actually receiving it. And that's largely related to the need for 24/7 presence of trained technical support, as well as having a trained expert to read the waveforms. You know, as you pointed out, traditional EEG looks like you're looking at an oscilloscope, you know, with these electrical patterns that are passing across the screen in time. That is an art form. And there's a great deal of information that is lost in that kind of interpretation. And that kind of interpretation really can only be performed by trained experts who really only provide those reads on a, you know, once or at most twice daily basis. As you can imagine, that's not very useful for continuously monitoring a patient that may have a brain injury. And so for all of these reasons, EEG is really not used. And as a result, we are basically not functionally using what is by far the best way to monitor brain health.
And, you know, that raises the issue. Obviously, we have this enormous problem of essentially brain injury that comes from, you know, strokes, traumatic brain injury, you know, huge interest in all of that, cardiac problems. Tell us a little bit about your concept and how you arrived at this innovation that says let's turn this around, turn that 1% into the exception versus the current rule.
I think, you know, as a neurosurgery resident, we all start off early in residency being primarily responsible for taking care of patients in the ICU that have suffered a variety of brain injuries. And what we all experience is that there is this black box effect where the patient may be in a coma or have significantly depressed neurological function, and we have no accurate means of assessing what's happening in the brain. That wouldn't be such a problem if there were just kind of a single static episode where the brain were injured and, you know, we just kind of managed from there. But the reality is, in the vast majority of brain injuries, as well as in other pathologies like cardiac situations, as you mentioned, brain health, just like any other organ, is heavily dependent on the general health of the body. So if the brain's not getting enough blood flow, it's at risk of having, you know, kind of oxygen deprivation induced or glucose deprivation induced injury. In many situations where the brain is injured, it swells, and the brain is protected very effectively by the skull, but it's trapped inside the skull. So if the brain is swelling, then obviously the pressure goes up, which can cause further brain damage. Externally, we have no way of effectively evaluating that. And we can perform CT scans or the neurological exam. I've got to be honest, what we all learn to depend on primarily is the bedside nurse, who by far has the best sense of what's happening with that patient. And there have been a variety of other means that have been used for monitoring the brain, but many of them are invasive. They require us to drill a hole in the head and insert a probe into the brain itself, and it only monitors a small part of the brain, and a lot of those things are not very effective. So I think that is what inspires, obviously, many, many neurosurgeons and neuroscientists and people who take care of patients with brain injury to try to find a better way of monitoring brain health. I am not by any means, you know, a kind of a member of the high echelon of people that are pushing the field forward in terms of understanding the pathological changes in the EEG that go along with brain injury. One of my colleagues, Jan Klassen, who's the director of the Neurocritical Care Unit at Columbia, is an international expert on understanding this, and he has spent several decades studying scalp EEG and looking at these kinds of changes in patients with brain injury. What we're trying to do is basically marry up all of that knowledge, you know, the insights that people in kind of the academic world have about the utility of EEG and brain injury, and take that into something that can be put in the smallest community hospital that is still, you know, taking care of the same patients with brain injury. We need to flatten out the world and take that art that exists, you know, in kind of these rare high-level centers and be able to generalize it across the field. And the tool that we are building is hopefully going to help with that. You know, the initial idea is that we can provide better data about brain health in real time. But as we collect that data, we're obviously going to be using, you know, processes to develop initial systems that will at least warn if there are concerning changes, you know, on a moment-to-moment basis, but ultimately use that data along with kind of our combined clinical knowledge and some preclinical modeling to develop means by which therapy is driven by the data that we're getting back from the EEG. That's obviously kind of a long-term process, but we realized early on that we had to start with better data. You know, right now the data sets that exist are just not, they're not integrated. They need to be curated by hand so that noise can be removed, so, you know, it can be more amenable to these quantitative algorithms that will give us much more detailed information about the EEG in real time. And that process, you know, what we're doing is not new in that regard, but controlling the input and controlling the processing subsequently is really what we're hoping to bring and allow us to generalize this technology kind of across the field.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Dr. Alan Waziri, a neurosurgeon, translational neuroscientist, and CEO and co-founder of ICE Neurosystems. We were just talking about the sort of lead up to this, and the ICE Neurosystem, tell us what that is and how that works, what's unique about it.
So we, from the beginning, we realized that in order for this to be effective, we had to solve the problem from front to back. That would include acquiring better data kind of at the outset, but then having all of the processing machinery, the data integration tools, and then ultimately kind of a clinical decision support system that would really allow this technology to be generalized across the healthcare landscape. In terms of improving the signal quality, we recognize that there are just intrinsic physical limitations to trying to record electrical activity using metallic contacts on the scalp. There have been many, many, many different attempts to improve upon that. And there are some very, very good technologies out there now that can accomplish that for the short term. But the reality is that the biological interface between metallic contacts and the scalp is poor. And it requires a lot of maintenance. The data is noisy. So our initial approach, and it's something that we've literally been working on for 15 years, was to develop means by which electrodes could be placed subcutaneously that would allow us to record high quality, low noise EEG from both sides of the brain. But another key aspect of that is that it cannot require a trained technician. So we spent a great deal of time developing techniques that would allow essentially, somebody with limited clinical experience at the bedside to be able to place these devices and functionalize them without any specific, kind of knowledge of the wiring associated with EEG. So we take that kind of high fidelity, high quality, easy to perform data, and that goes into a software system that we've generated in-house. But that software is also simultaneously bringing in the systemic physiological data that's critical for understanding what might be going on that's affecting the brain. Things like heart rate, blood pressure, oxygen saturation, temperature, intracranial pressure, all these things that we normally monitor in the intensive care unit or in the emergency room or in the operating room that people are used to seeing on the bedside monitor. So we take a feed from that data set and we integrate those two forms of data, the EEG along with the systemic data. And so from the very beginning, we've got a data set that is completely locked together so that at any moment in time, we can trace through the patient's physiology to find out if there's something going on with the brain, what may be going on physiologically that we can intervene upon. So we then take a series of algorithms, which are not by any means, ours or novel. These are things that have been known for years. But the key is that we take that high quality EEG and we run it through a number of quantitative algorithms that provide a graphic output that a clinician without specialized EEG knowledge can interpret. So there's kind of color-coded graphs. There are numbers that tell us about, changes in EEG power. We can look at ratios of different frequency bands in the EEG, and that reduces the EEG from what you were mentioning before, which is a series of squiggles on the oscilloscope, to something that is much more digestible in the routine clinical environment. And we create a graphic user interface that allows a clinician to see what's happening in real time, but then look back over time to see trends. And so the user interface is really designed to function more like current technology rather than a medical device. You can move things around with your finger, you can overlay graphs, and that really allows a clinician to understand what's happening with the brain in relationship with what's happening with the patient over time. And that's really critical, not just for trying to understand what's happened in the past and what's happening now, but as we change our interventions as a result, you can track those interventions and the effects of those interventions going into the future. This does not currently exist. And, on top of that, we understand that physicians are never really at the bedside anymore. So from the outset, our platform is designed to be interfaced from any number of devices, a desktop computer in a physician's office, on their phone in the lunchroom. But we also have a cloud-based platform that allows people to identify, changes in data that may be happening in real time when they're outside the hospital and at home. And I guess the advantage that we have, in addition to having probably over 90 years of combined clinical EEG experience amongst our co-founders, is that we've been on the ground and really understand just the practical difficulties with caring for these patients. And so from the very beginning, the concept was that we would design a system that would be easy to use, addressable by people without specialized training, would not require a significant amount of troubleshooting, would provide all the data that we would want to see in terms of caring for those patients in real time. The data would be accessible in any location. And ultimately, that's been kind of the driving force behind the cross-platform development. One additional variable that we're working on is a what we're calling a telecurbside support service. So obviously everybody's talked about telemedicine quite a bit, but a lot of hospitals don't need true telemedicine. You know, they've got excellent intensivists, general intensivists who may be taking care of brain injured patients. They just need that 5 or 10%, you know, on top of their, you know, kind of basic, you know, high level intensive care knowledge in terms of dealing with the, you know, the variables that are more specific to brain health. That's one thing about medicine, as you know now, we were just, you know, kind of talking before about the enormous amount of information that's coming along. It is impossible for people to stay on top of all of those things. You integrate that reality with the fact that hospitals are trying to retain the most complicated, you know, kind of high complexity patients for reimbursement purposes. But then at the same time, you have this increasing focus on quality and outcomes. And so you have, you know, this kind of situation where people are trapped in terms of taking care of very sick patients with very complicated problems, but having to achieve very, very high quality outcomes. Our telecurbside support service is basically going to utilize the data that we acquire through our system to provide just a little bit of a nudge or guidance to a physician in a local setting that may need some help with interpreting what's going on with the brain in that situation. Ultimately, where we're going is that we hope to kind of replace ourselves, you know, as we develop the AI side of this. That's a ways down the road, but, you know, in order for us to effectively be able to develop that AI, we need better data from the outset. And that's, you know, ultimately what we're trying to acquire.
So, you know, fascinating insights. And I think one of the things that I want to pull out that I hear repeatedly on this, you know, incremental theme is the length of time. You talk about 15 years to get to this point. Any thoughts about the sort of inflection points or the learning as you look back on that, where you go, wow, that really helped in terms of the innovation and the pathway?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. Hadn't really thought a lot about those inflection points until recently, but this work started in probably 2003, 2004, and at that time, the concept was we were going to try to get better EEG data by drilling a hole in the patient's head at the bedside and placing a little electrode into the brain, and that really worked great. But that's obviously not a solution that can be generalized to the, you know, 1.4 million patients in the U.S. who need to have continuous EEG. We had developed some IP kind of around that time, the idea was that starting a company when I was coming straight out of residency with this limited amount of technology and without having any really insight into how the business world worked, that was just really kind of a non-starter. So that idea got put on the shelf a little bit, but we continued to do research over the years. And then just over the past couple of years, just serendipitously, technology's gotten better. The need has become much clearer in terms of how useful EEG is and how it should be, you know, kind of generalized across the field. But then ultimately, you know, the emergence of the startup culture, I think, is what influenced it as well. It's a lot easier to start a company now, I think, than it was 10 years ago. There's a lot more guidance, there's a lot more resources. So I think it's a combination of serendipity, timing, and just waiting for the right moment that led to the decision for us to move forward on this project.
Fantastic. So unfortunately, we're almost out of time, which is extraordinarily frustrating because we didn't even get to talk about the metaphysical aspect of this and, you know, dealing with people's brains and, you know, the whole concept. Any parting thoughts in the last minute or so of where you think this is going and where the opportunity lies?
So I think that the real opportunity here is to move towards what we in the medical field really know is coming anyway, is towards artificial intelligence-based care. Ultimately, it can't be highly trained specialists in ivory towers who are providing the best care. That art of medicine needs to be translated to artificial intelligence so that everyone can benefit from our increasing understanding of the brain. And I think more and more elements of medicine are moving towards that. It's going to be kind of a staged process, but we're hoping to be a central part of that, you know, going into the future, particularly for taking care of patients with brain injury.
Fantastic. Well, as always, we've run out of time. Just delighted to have this conversation. So excited about the progress. I think this is an extraordinarily valuable contribution to the increasing understanding of that brain injury. And I think the insights that you'll develop and the tools that are going to come out of this are just going to be extraordinary. So very excited to have you. Alan, thanks for joining me today.
Nick, can't thank you enough for the opportunity. It was fantastic.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.